Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
If you'd like to turn in your Bibles to the Old Testament book of Esther, we'll be continuing our journey through Esther in a few moments. It is good to see everyone here this evening, and as Fred mentioned in his prayer, we're thankful for all of our high schoolers that were able to be part of Evangelism University. If you don't know what Evangelism University, or EU, is, it's a special weekend in Savannah, Tennessee, but one of the distinguishing characteristics of it is it offers a lot of classes specifically focused on how our young people can not only grow in their faith, but share their faith. And they deal with a lot of really specific, interesting topics and important topics for them. And so it's always a great growth opportunity. And I'm thankful that our young people are involved in that. We also have a group of guys that will be leaving tomorrow morning. Our goal is to leave at 8 a.m. Now we are going to be enjoying some basketball and visiting the Bass Pro there and the Pyramid. We watch the Grizzlies play. We do this every year because it's the one day game they play. And we enjoy it whether they win or lose, which is good because they typically have lost. And we've typically enjoyed it. So that's what we're going to plan on doing tomorrow. So if you're going to be part of that, be sure that you're here so we can leave by 8. Also, in just a couple of weeks, on February the 3rd, we're going to be taking a group to lectureship for a day at Fried Hardeman. And if you go out here in the foyer, you can find some schedules like this one that give you an idea of what's going to be happening throughout the day. Our own Jonathan Winchester will be speaking that afternoon, and so we want to be there to support him for that. But there are also several other things throughout the day that you'll want to be a part of, and so pick up one of those schedules, sign up so we can know to expect you and to be part of that trip as well. Well, this morning we began with a fable, and so let's throw another one in tonight as we begin thinking through Esther chapter 3. You may have heard the one about two rival eagles. There was one eagle who was stronger than the other. He could fly higher and go faster, and the smaller and weaker one didn't like that very much. And so the eagle that kept losing the race found a sportsman, a hunter. And he was out hunting with his bow and arrow, and the eagle said, "I want you to take down my rival." And there that eagle was, flying up overhead. And the sportsman said, "I could do that." And he took out his bow, and he shot the arrow, but it missed the eagle. It couldn't go that high, not as high as that eagle was flying. And so the sportsman told the eagle, "I need another feather." And so that eagle took off one of his feathers, put it on that arrow so it could fly even further, but even that wasn't high enough. And so the rival eagle did it again and again and again until he didn't have any more feathers left where he could fly. And the hunter turned around and found an eagle that wasn't going to fly away from him. And it cost that rival eagle his life. He kept giving what was his only way of surviving in an effort to take someone else down. If we have that fable in mind, we're well prepared to be introduced to a man named Haman. And what Haman does is he builds a gallows in the passage we're going to read. He builds a place where someone could be hung, but he doesn't realize he's building it for himself. He's building his own gallows. And so as we begin, if you're in Esther chapter 3, we're going to start by thinking through what takes place as we're introduced to Haman. Beginning in verse 1, "After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, 'Why are you transgressing the king's command?' Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told him that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among your peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries." Now, we've been introduced in the past couple of weeks to the king, and your translation may say King Ahasuerus. The Greek name Xerxes is a lot easier to say, and so that's the one I typically use. So if we say Xerxes, that's who we're talking about. And we saw what happened with his queen, Vashti, when she wouldn't come before him and his friends when they were drunk at a feast. He got rid of her. We saw what took place when he sent out servants to find him a new queen. And we learned last week it was not what we would consider a traditional beauty pageant. It probably was a lot more like human trafficking, where women from all over were taken in, young ladies, and they were part of the king's harem, and now they couldn't have a life of their own. Now they were going to be part of the king's harem, serving as his concubines. Esther is chosen to be queen. We've also been introduced to Mordecai. Mordecai is the family member who raises Esther, who warns her not to tell anybody that she is a Jew, and so even the king doesn't know that. But now we see the seeds of conflict here in a man named Haman. Now, as we think about Haman, as we learn more about him, I just want to remind us of a passage in Proverbs chapter 6. There's a passage in Proverbs that describes things that God hates, which is a pretty important list. If my Creator says there are some things that I hate, I want to know what's on that list. Here is what we read, beginning in verse 16. There are six things which the Lord hates. Yes, seven which are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Now that wasn't written about Haman, but it's a pretty good description of what we're going to see in Haman's life. In the passage we read, we found out that Haman was not just one of the king's advisors. He was second to the king himself. No one other than the king had as much influence or power as Haman did. And so when he would walk around, people would bow to him. But Mordecai wasn't going to bow to Haman. You see, Haman and Mordecai have a little bit of a history. It develops here. But really, we can chart it all the way back to their families. You see, Haman was an Agagite. That links him to the group called the Amalekites. King Agag was the king of the Amalekites. And we can go all the way back to Exodus 17. Let me just read you a couple of verses from the Old Testament that sort of chart the course here for the conflict. In verse 16 of Exodus 17, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. "Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt, how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget." So there's already conflict between the Israelites and the Amalekites. And then when Saul is made king in 1 Samuel 15, Saul is told by God when they destroy the Amalekites that he's to destroy the king. He's to put the king to death, Agag. He doesn't do that. Samuel has to. Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. And Benjamin is the tribe that generations later produces Mordecai. So already in the text, we've got a clue that these two are going to have conflict, because you have one who's from the tribe of Saul, the king, and you have another who's connected to King Agag. You know there's going to be conflict. And so when Haman walks through, he realizes that Mordecai is not bowing down to him. Now, there are a couple of things I want us to think about. First of all, Israelites didn't have a problem with bowing to show respect. That wasn't an issue. Israelites often bowed to their king. But what Mordecai seems to be saying when they question him is that he's a Jew, and so perhaps this is his form of protest. I'm not going to bow down to this Persian influential person. Now, we know to some extent Mordecai lived his life kind of assimilated among this group. So maybe this is just one area he says, I'm going to refuse to bow down to this person. And if you noticed in the text, I thought this was interesting. I don't know if I had seen this before or if I'd been told it, I'd forgotten it. But it's interesting that Haman doesn't really see what Mordecai has done until people tell him what happens. Because in verse 3, the king's servants start to question why Mordecai isn't bowing. And then they told Haman about it. Well, now Haman's looking for it. And have you ever had that experience where you might have gotten something, maybe you've mowed your lawn and it looks beautiful and you've seeded the grass and things look beautiful, and then you find just that one spot that just doesn't look right? In our yard growing up, it was the spot that just for some reason it could never grow grass. And eventually my dad, through some detective work, figured out that was the spot where I would stand to shoot free throws on our basketball goal. That was my free throw line, and it never could grow grass, because I was trying really hard to make free throws, and that wasn't going well either. And so you had both of those things happening. You can look through the whole lawn, but that one spot, just that one thing. So Haman walks out. He has all of these people who were bowing to him, but there's one guy that's not. And that drives Haman crazy. Now just stop and think about this for a minute. There is no one other than the king who is more influential, has more power, and probably would have had more wealth. We see Haman's wealth later on. Then Haman. There's nobody else. Who else does he have to be jealous of? But he just couldn't handle one person choosing not to bow down to him. I think it's worth stopping to realize that we typically have goals in our mind, and we think once we've achieved this specific goal, this mile marker, this position, that's when things are really going to come together for us. Boy, once I get to that level, and you've experienced it, you know what it's like. When you get to that point, you realize, you know, I'm still not perfect. Life still isn't perfect. I've still got issues we're dealing with. It's interesting to me that our society seems to really function on that idea, that attitude, that if I could just get to a certain level of success and wealth, then things would be great. And how many documentaries do we have to watch or biographies do we have to read before we realize even the people who are in those influential positions are struggling? You know, it was just a few years ago when Bruce Springsteen made headlines because his autobiography, his memoirs came out, and he revealed the serious issues he had in his 30s. That while he was an incredibly popular musician, and that people, there was a whole industry of people that wanted to have his success, he had a hard time sleeping at night. There were issues, real issues in his life he was struggling with. And it made the news, and he started doing interviews because people are still surprised. We're still constantly surprised when we find out that people who have success and wealth still have issues. Haman might have had a lot of influence, but Haman also had issues. And there was something about Mordecai not standing that just drove him crazy. And if you want some insight into Haman's mind, look at the way that he decides to deal with this. Because a typical way that you might deal with it is he might call someone out. He might, in front of everybody, call out Mordecai and shame him for not bowing down to him. He might tell the guards to make him bow down. Now, we would look at that and we would say, well, Haman has problems. But that would also seem like something a typical ruler would do. That's not what Haman wanted to do. Haman decided he wanted to get rid of all of the Jews. Because if Mordecai says he's not going to bow down because he's a Jew, what if that starts catching? What if others decide not to do that? No, we need to get rid of them all. I mean, think about this response. He even tells Xerxes when he goes and speaks to him that I will, if you let this happen, I will donate 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to be put into the treasury. In other words, here's a law I'd like you to pass, and I've got 10,000 talents of silver to donate to the cause. Now, it's notoriously difficult to try to get an exact monetary amount to a talent, especially in this era of time. But this is very clearly a great deal of wealth that he's willing to spend because one person wouldn't bow to him. Now, ultimately, that there's some deeper issues here, but because Mordecai wouldn't bow down, now he's willing to give 10,000 talents. I mean, it's like seeing an ant, and you want to take care of an ant, and you're taking out a machine gun. There's so much more power here than he really needs to employ, but he's determined. He's going to get rid of all of these people. And so you have in Haman and Mordecai the continuation of a conflict that we've seen all throughout the Old Covenant. And so as he goes through this process and as it's approved, we get to the passage in Esther chapter 4 that we read last week. Once Mordecai finds out what's happening, he goes to Esther. He tells her about Haman's plot. He tells her in verse 14, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And that's been the title of our series, "Such a Time as This." And so Esther decides she's got a strategy here. And she's going to do this in a way that's a little surprising to us, but it tells us a lot about that culture as well. She's going to try this diplomatic solution. And so Esther takes her life into her own hands by going before the king. If he doesn't extend his scepter, then that could be the end for her, and we know that he doesn't have a problem getting rid of queens. And so he does. She invites him to a banquet. There's going to be a banquet. And not only that, but if it pleases the king, why don't you bring Haman to the banquet? Now, if there's anything that could get Haman's mind off Mordecai not bowing to him, it is getting to be the one person who is invited to a banquet with the king and the queen. It doesn't get much better than that. I mean, if you were an average person who is an advisor to the king and you were the only one invited, that should dominate your mind. And so they go to this banquet. And the king asks Esther, okay, what is the petition you have for me? In a move that's interesting, it tells us a little bit about ancient culture, but also I think we see some wisdom here, at least in the way diplomatic decisions are made. She says, I tell you what, let's have another banquet. Let's leave some suspense. Let's leave some drama here. And in the ensuing night, there's a lot that happens. And so Haman went out that day, in verse 9 of Esther chapter 5, pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. So here he is again. Now Mordecai certainly doesn't want to bow before Haman, because now he knows what Haman's trying to do. Who's going to bow before the person who's behind this plot, who spearheaded, masterminded this plot? And so he's not going to bow down before him. And this makes Haman furious. And the incredible privilege of going to eat with the king and queen, that's now out the window. All he can think about is Mordecai. And so he controls himself, goes to his house, sends for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And then verse 11 of chapter 5 is just... it's just fascinating to me. You've just got to imagine Haman doing this. Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. I mean, isn't that something you want to be part of? To be around your friend when he just gives you his highlight reel of, did you know I've accomplished this? And what about the time where I did this? And do you know how many sons I have? And do you know how much money I have? What Haman is doing is he's trying to make himself feel better by reminding himself of the things we think make us feel good. The things we think give us success. But there is an underlying issue here. And that's why when we try to make ourselves feel better, by focusing on our success and on us and what we have and what we've done, we have a hard time really feeling better. Because those things, if we're just viewing them as ways to magnify ourselves, aren't going to give us that kind of satisfaction. And so it's not going to be enough. And it's not enough for Haman. He says in verse 13, "Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Can I just take a moment to remind us tonight? It doesn't matter what my lists are, my goals, my accomplishments, the thing we've achieved. If all I'm focused on is self, there will always be a Mordecai somewhere. There will always be something somewhere. If I'm just focused on myself and what I can do, I'll never be happy. There'll always be something that's nagging at me, and I'll never be able to enjoy it. It's a matter of priorities. And so Haman is furious. And so Zeresh and his wife and all his friends said, after hearing about how great Haman was, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." Now they've given him a plan of action. What could be better than building a gallows for the person that you want to see hanged and then having the power to go to the king, and the king's going to do what he says? "You won't bow down to me. We'll see who the king listens to." It's incredible. And so he's ready. But that's not the only action that's taking place between these two banquets. The other one is in Esther chapter 6. The king is having a hard time sleeping. And so he asks for them to come and to read the historical record to him. Maybe there's something about that that would make him sleepy. Or maybe he just wants to be productive and brush up on history. And so it's found out in verse 2 that there had been a plot against the king to take his life, and that Mordecai had saved his life, had revealed the plot. And the king thinks, "Well, I must have really taken care of him. We must have really honored him." And then he finds out no one honored Mordecai. And so Haman's thinking about Mordecai and envisioning the gallows. And so while Haman is over here planning out in his mind how he's going to build this gallows, the king is over here thinking, "How am I going to honor Mordecai?" Isn't that interesting? Two powerful people with two opposite purposes. And so then the king has Haman come before him. And as if we didn't already think Haman thought a lot of himself, the king says to Haman, What should I do for a man the king delights to honor?" And Haman thinks, "It's got to be me, right?" I mean, he's standing in the presence of the king, and who knows how many people work for the king and how many things happen, but Haman is just sure there's no way he's talking about anyone but me. It's got to be me. He just recounted his list of accomplishments to all his family and his friends. He could probably do it again for the king. And so Haman starts thinking big to the king. He said, "I tell you what, for the king, the guy the king desires to honor," he says in verse 7 or verse 8, "let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" I have to wonder if Haman has visualized this before talking to the king. Now, we don't know that. The text doesn't tell us that. But I like to imagine that when the king asks Haman this question, it's almost as if Haman is saying, "You know, I'm glad you asked. I've thought a lot about this. Here's what I'd like. Picture this: one of your horses, one of your robes, and being led by one of your princes through the streets, and you'll say, 'This is the one the king desires to honor.' After all, how could Mordecai even hope to keep from bowing down if he's in one of the king's robes and if everybody's parading him as the one the king desires to honor?" And verse 10, the king thinks this is a great idea. He says, "Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said." And so look at what happens in verse 11. "So Haman took the robe and the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" I know it's not possible, but I'd love for us to somehow be able to hear the tone of voice in Haman when he says, "This is the man the king desires to honor"? I mean, was there a lot of energy and enthusiasm? How did that carry through? He has to live out what would be his nightmare, the very person he was consumed with taking down. Now he's got to honor him. And so we see it's going to be more than just a what goes around comes around, but there's a little bit of that here as well. And you have to wonder, I think when you have discussions about whether or not the Lord has a sense of humor, I think this has to be right up there as a way in which God is bringing Haman down a couple of notches, but Haman is still consistent in his plan. Now, his plan was that the Jews would be attacked, and that was in the law of the Medes and Persians, which couldn't be changed, and so it was set in stone. And so Esther has a plea that she makes at her next banquet, and it comes out, as Esther says, the plot that's against her people. And when she sees that the king is recognizing this and realizes in verse 8, for example, the king says in chapter 7, verse 8, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbonah, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." Now, I don't know if we've seen a reversal of fortunes in Scripture that really rivals how quickly the tables turn for Haman. Haman starts out the day thinking, "I've got a plan. I'm going to take down Mordecai." He finds himself parading Mordecai through the city, and then he ends up being hanged on the gallows that he built for Mordecai. After all, Mordecai's the one who'd saved the king's life. Haman's the one who was plotting to kill the queen and all her people. So what does that tell us, other than being an interesting story? It shows us that Haman was so focused on the destruction of Mordecai that that focus destroyed him. He was so focused on Mordecai's destruction, it led to his own destruction. And so even though in his mind he might have been visualizing how satisfying it would be when he would get his revenge, he'd never realized he was building his own gallows. And maybe it's easy for us to let ourselves off the hook with this one, because we say, "Well, I'm not as bad as Haman. I mean, there's no way. There's no way I would want to plan a genocide to take out a whole group of people." But you know, if we don't allow our lives to be shaped by the love of God, then jealousy can consume us. We can have that same kind of jealousy, that same kind of focus on someone else's life, and it can consume who we are. It can lead to our destruction. There's a story that Paul Harvey used to tell that is a great visual illustration of this process. And it was said that this is what Eskimo hunters would do when they were seeking to kill a wolf, that the Eskimo would coat his knife in animal blood and let it freeze, and then another layer of blood and another until that knife is completely covered with these frozen layers of blood. Then he would fix the knife in the ground with the blade up, and the wolf would follow that nose that was telling him where the blood is and would find that blade and would just lap that blood vigorously until the keen edge was bare, but would keep harder and harder licking for it because of that taste for blood, and not realizing that at this point it's its own blood that's being cut by the knife, that it's consuming itself. Now, that's a traditional story that's been handed down throughout generations. Some have claimed, well, that's not really the way they hunted, and maybe that's not an effective way to go about it. But I can tell you, it visualizes the process here very well, because that's what happens to us. We keep consuming and consuming, and we don't realize we're just consuming ourselves. We're not hurting the person that we're jealous of. Haman was already in the process of consuming himself with jealousy, and that never affected Mordecai. That didn't hurt Mordecai, but he was consumed. He was eaten up with it. And so maybe I've never planned something as drastic as Haman did, But maybe I've rehearsed in the car on the way to see somebody that I know I have a problem with. I've rehearsed some comebacks. Here's what I'd say. I'd say, I'm going to say this. You know what? If they say this, here's what I'm going to say. You kind of psych yourself up. You get pumped up. I'm going to go and I'm going to tell him this and this and this. Or after an interaction, we start thinking, I know what I'll do next time. I'll do this. And we start to kind of enjoy that. We start to dwell on that a little bit. And you know, and that'll really put her in her place. That'll put him in his place. And as we do that, that consumption just continually eats away at us. Some people have said that holding a grudge is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die, to be hurt by it. But really, you're only hurting yourself. That's what we see here with Haman. Our own jealousies can consume us. And so tonight, it's worth it for me to stop and ask, do I have some jealousy issues in my life that are consuming me? Am I looking at what something someone else has and saying, boy, I wish I had that. I wish I could be like that. And it's consumed me. Is it a matter of material possessions that someone else has that I'm lusting after? Is it a certain position that someone else holds that I think I could do a better job? I'd rather have that. What is it? Because if I allow it to consume me, it will eat away at me. Our own jealousies can consume us. And only God is able to forgive us. Because ultimately, all of us would fit in the Haman category. All of us have sought to glorify ourselves. All of us have gotten caught up in our own self-promotion and our own indulgence in who we are and being egocentric and just caring about us. And actually, the message of the gospel is that all of us deserve what Haman received, punishment. And yet the message of Scripture is there is forgiveness. The only way I'll be able to deal with jealousy in my life is if God helps me through those times. The only way I'll be able to find a resource to help me battle it is through prayer to Him. The only way I'll be able to sustain and to succeed is to be taking my issues to God, allowing God to be the one who's in charge of who gets what punishment. That's actually God's position. It's not mine. And if I start living as if I'm going to be the one to dole out God's punishment, I'm trying to put myself in His place. That's why Paul would remind the Romans that God says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. God's in charge of that. And by the way, I need forgiveness. All of us do. And so if I'm so caught up in being jealous of something else, I'll never see my own needs. Tonight, let's take just a moment to learn from Haman. Let's learn from what he did. Let's think about what we're tempted to do. And let's be reminded of what God has done for us. Let's not allow ourselves to be consumed by jealousy or envy or revenge or a grudge. Let's give those to the Lord. And let's enjoy the fact that God provides forgiveness and that He's ultimately in control. He will make a way. It may be that you need to become a child of God tonight, that you need to access that forgiveness. Scripture tells us that forgiveness is available when we give our lives over to God. When we put Christ on in baptism, that's a moment where we begin a new life and we receive that forgiveness and share it with others. It may be that somewhere along the way, you've lost sight of what you should be doing, and the account of Haman sounds a little more like your personal life than you'd like to admit. And maybe tonight's the night you can start over and start fresh and allow us to pray with you and for you. If there's any way we can help, please come as we stand and as we sing together.
Soul of Savior, thou art needing. Soul of Savior.